You're listening to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. Now live in the studio, local mortgage and finance experts Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, the Saturday, October 6th show. I'm Tina Mitchell, Mortgage Diva, and sitting to my left is my co-host, the Mortgage Master, Mike Mercer.
How are you doing, Tina?
Awesome. You ready for a great show?
I am absolutely ready.
We got our studio packed today.
I know.
Exciting. Thank you for taking time with us today to talk money. Mike and I are here every Saturday on AM 1090 at 3 p.m. Each week, we share expert advice and inside knowledge on how today's events and our local economy will affect your money. Mike, why don't you introduce who we have in studio today?
Well, our first guest is Jim Einot, who's been practicing law on the East Side for over 30 years. I've personally known Jim for, 12 to 13, 14 years. And today he's going to be talking about estate planning.
That's a topic that everybody needs to know about.
And our second guest is Inger Lawrence with Windermere Real Estate. And Inger has been practicing real estate since 1996. She focuses on primarily in-city single-family residences and multifamily projects. But what's interesting is she's got a real strong background with construction as well as design. So we're
That's a good combination for a strong realtor.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to getting your home prepared the right way, she's going to really touch on and shed some light on some stuff I'm sure we've never heard before. So
you definitely want to stay tuned. Don't miss out on the show today. Mike, why don't we go ahead and start out with a little money chat?
Let's do it. So, Tina, I came across this article on Forbes magazine, and it was titled The 10 Common Credit Myths That Could Be Costing You Money. And you and I, of course, deal with this kind of stuff on a daily basis. But
many, many times on a daily basis.
So here's what there's 10 points here I want to go over real quickly, and then you and I can kind of give our opinions on it. But the first one, the credit myth, was I haven't done anything wrong with my credit, so my credit should be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And as you and I know, we sit down with clients all the time, and they come in and they say they think their credit score is perfect or great. And once we pull their credit and we look at it, they're sometimes shocked to see that maybe there's some things on there that they never knew about. The report states that 70% of all credit reports have an error on them. And I think, what they're really saying is not that there's 70% have fraud. What they're simply saying
violations.
Is that, right.
Yep.
What they're simply saying is that something that they could have well been aware of that was on there could be just reporting wrong.
Mm-hmm. And the violations are huge, and that's a whole other topic. But that's what the Fair Credit Reporting Act is there for. And 8 out of 10 consumers don't realize that they're being violated by how it's reporting to the credit bureaus. Another
right.
topic for another show. But
yep. The second thing was, if I check my credit, it will hurt my score. And, they said checking your own report generally doesn't hurt your score, but errors do. So don't let that be an excuse to not check it. A lot of people are like, I don't want my credit checked. I'm afraid to look at it because it's going to drop my scores. Well, by all means, it's way more important to take a look at your credit and see what is actually on there and what's reporting. And this is a common question that comes up too when we're meeting with clients, like, hey, I don't want you guys to pull my credit. I'm afraid it's going to hurt my scores.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of this is, and I actually had a phone conversation with our credit guy, Thomas Rowland, this morning talking about this subject. And he said, Mike, the thing is that you never really know. For example, you could pull a client's credit report and their scores might be 5 points off than where they saw it last time, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that you pulled their report. It could have been that 30 days prior to that, a credit card went up in balance.
Mm-hmm.
Or they had some new spending. And so you never really exactly know. But in all fairness, it does report that an inquiry has been done on your credit. But as far as it actually dropping your scores, that's a really hard thing to nail down. So the third thing, I've checked my credit report and there is no errors. I don't have anything to worry about. And, we get this from time to time with clients. But the thing is that most of these free credit report type advertisement places that market this kind of stuff, you're only really getting one credit bureau for the pull. And as we know, there's 3 credit bureaus, right? Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. So you have to be leery. Just because you go to one of these places and you pull a score, you got to realize that there's 2 additional bureaus that are reporting. So you're not really doing yourself a favor by going to those places because it still can be inaccurate. The fourth thing is I can check my credit reports for a free with, for example, freecreditreport.com. And many sites like this, like I just said, give you only access to one report. But there's another agency that you can go through called annualcreditreport.com, which actually will allow you to access all 3 bureaus and allows you to check every 12 months for free.
The only caution on that, Mike, is the score that they're actually getting, whether or not it's accurate, because there's so many times that the score is being reported. As you know, when we look at the credit report, somebody comes in with their score and it's completely different. I think it's great to pull
right.
that to see what's happening with the credit report. But as far as the scores, I wouldn't bank on those.
I totally agree. Next thing, I should always make my payments on old debts. And, you know, that's interesting. You know, while that might feel like that's the right thing to do, here's what's interesting. The debt collector will be unable to sue you for any debts that are older than the state's statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting, though, is if you start to make payments, though, on old debts, you could actually reactivate that time period and give the creditor a chance to file a lawsuit against you.
So here's a call to action. If you're listening right now, you need to call the Money Hour, 1-888-776-1090, or go online, themoneyhour.com. We will connect you with the best of the best of credit expert. You need to have somebody advising you, because Mike and I, we don't know all these things. We pick up some stuff, we read an article, and it's like, wow, that really, really, there's something to think about. But unless you're doing it every day, things change all the time. You need expert advice to see how you can save thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah. And, you know, they say here that if you have stuff that's, you know, 7 years or older, technically that stuff shouldn't even be reporting, you know, on your report.
Yep.
But yet we see stuff that does that all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's where these credit guys can come in. And that's what they're so good about, is getting that stuff removed.
79% or 8 out of 10 consumers will have violations on their credit report.
So another thing they talked about was, I should use a debt settlement company. And, you know, they said, well, not necessarily. You know, the first thing that debt settlement companies usually do is they collect payments from you, but then they withhold them from the creditor mm-hmm. in order to settle the debt for a lower lump sum payment. The problem is that until the debt is settled, this kind of a strategy could really result in a lower credit score, you know, so harassing phone calls from the creditors and even a lawsuit against you. So if you have, you know, debt that's within your state's statute of limitations, but you can't afford, you know, to pay it back in full, for example, you could avoid the debt management company's fees and simply just reach out and try to settle it yourself. Always make sure that you're playing that card, though, letting them know that, you know, you're considering potentially filing bankruptcy. And another option is to work out maybe with a nonprofit credit counselor that can negotiate on your behalf, or like you just had mentioned, you know, reach out to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be more than happy to put somebody in contact with our credit people to give them some advice on that. The next one, I should always close a credit card after paying it off.
Oh my gosh, that's the biggest myth out there. Do not ever, ever, ever close anything that's 2 years or older.
Why is that?
15% of your credit is based on age of credit. So you can never reestablish once you close something out. That is the biggest myth out there. I can't tell you how many times consumers have came in and said, well, my gosh, I just closed out all these open accounts just like somebody told me to. What happened to my credit score? It was 700 and now it's 640. And that's not exaggerating at all. It's because they closed out accounts that are seasoned. And that's 15% of the pie that represents your credit score. And again, once those are closed out, there is no fixing that. You can't go back and get old accounts. Here's a little tip, though. If you don't have credit, get added to authorize users to your parents' accounts that have been open for 20 years. That's a way to kind of trick that system a little bit. But
that's right.
Do not close out open accounts that you're not using. Keep them open.
And unfortunately, the only time that they actually might have to do that
mm-hmm.
is when trying to qualify for a loan, right? Because, you know, now they used to be able to pay down a credit card to zero
mm-hmm.
and not have to close it to qualify. And over the last couple of years, they actually don't allow that anymore, right? So a lot of the underwriters will say, no, you actually have to pay that thing off, or not just pay it off, but just close it.
It depends. And so you want to look at the overall, yes, Mike, and it depends on what kind of loan they're going with and whether or not they're paying a massive amount off or little bits paid off. But yeah, that's something to... So there are some contradicting things. I do want to mention on the closing of accounts, and where that miss comes from is the other portion of your credit scoring, 10% is the mixed of credit. So in a perfect world, you want to have 3 revolving to 1 installment debt. So if you have 1 installment, which would be like a car or a mortgage or a student loan, and you have 6 revolving, you're messing up that perfect ratio to 1-3. So in that situation, you want to close out 3 of those revolving debts. But here's where it's contradicting. If you close out 3 of those revolving debt, if those debt are old, it's going to have a worse impact on your score than if you would have left those 6 revolving open. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So some of these things can be contradiction, and you just really, that's why you need to get a professional opinion and advice looking at your specific situation. So again, if you're listening today, it doesn't cost anything to have someone analyze your credit, just to take a look at it and see where you're at, some quick things that you could make adjustments to dramatically affect your credit score.
As far as qualifying for a loan, if you're told that you actually have to close an account, right,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in order to qualify, there's nothing wrong with reopening that account once the loan has been closed.
Yep. Right? And you want to make sure you're closing it after your credit's been pulled.
That's right. Okay. Bankruptcy is the end of the world.
Yeah.
Well, yes, it's painful, but you know,
it's not the end at all.
It's absolutely not the end. It can take 7 to 10 years to be removed from your credit report, but many people's credit scores actually, they remain good.
Well, and here's the myth to
credit.
Yeah, here's the myth to that too. Bankruptcy doesn't affect your credit score.
Yeah.
Are you listening right now? Bankruptcy does not affect your credit score. Now, someone's listening going, oh my gosh, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. It's not the bankruptcy that affects the credit scores. It's the lates that came from each individual account that went into bankruptcy. So if they're reporting incorrectly on your bankruptcy, your Nordstrom's card, your Macy's card, those can be completely deleted, those lates. And so now your credit score goes up. So it's not the actual bankruptcy that affects the credit score. It's the individual accounts that are part of the bankruptcy that are reporting lates during that time that dramatically affect your credit score. And here's the key is, again, 70% have violations to their credit. And this is a big one where those violations come in is on a bankruptcy. The way they're reporting the lates are not according to the way they're supposed to record them, which means what happens if somebody fights on your behalf? They completely get deleted.
And you brought up a good point earlier this morning because we were chatting about this and you had said it's like getting a speeding ticket, right? You might have been speeding. You might have been guilty of speeding. However, when you look at the ticket and you hire an attorney or you hire somebody to help you with get off on that ticket, they're not arguing the fact that you may or may not have been speeding. They're arguing the fact that how it was recorded, right?
Exactly.
How the report was written up. And I'm guilty. I've had speeding tickets. And
I've
had an attorney go in. And it's amazing. They've got me off
every
single time. And it's always a technicality. So that's what you're talking about here with the credit report. It's kind of the same thing. And, you know, if you file a Chapter 13 1 year from when you've settled on what the payment plan is going to be, you can actually buy a house. On a Chapter 7, it's just 2 years from when the discharge date is. So from a lending standpoint, bankruptcy is definitely not the end of the world. Okay, maintaining a balance on my credit cards will increase my credit score. That's kind of a myth. Opening and using a credit card can actually increase your score, especially if you're, you know, starting to build or rebuild your credit. But keeping a balance will only increase your interest payments. If you know, so if anything, the opposite is true. If you have credit cards and you're using them, you just want to make sure that you're trying to pay them off, you know, on a monthly basis.
And you want to make sure that you never get over the ratio of 30% of what you currently have available to you. The worst is over 50%. So there's another piece of the pie. 30% is the ratio of what you owe versus what's available to you. And this is another thing that takes a little quick fix. If you have a Visa card and you have a limit or available credit to you of $5,000, if you owe more than $2,500 on that, devastating for your credit score. Ideally, you want to keep it at not more than 30%. So that would be 5,000, 30% of that would be, what, 1,500?
1,500.
We do math for a living. Yeah. So if you can keep it there, that's the better ratio. So here's the simple fix for that is not everybody has, if you owe 3,000 instead of 2,500 on that 5,000 available credit limit to you, not everybody has an extra $500 to pay it off. What you can do is call the credit card company and see if you can get the available credit to you increased or move it over to another card.
Yeah.
That you don't owe anything on or you're less than that. So keep that ratio another big part of your credit scoring.
That's absolutely the biggest shocker to most people is they come in and they see their credit report and they flip out because they're like, I've never been late on anything in my entire life. I pay all my bills, I pay everything on time, but it's the balances that they were carrying versus the credit limit that was making those credit scores go down.
Yep.
So, and then in closing, I need to pay a company like LifeLock to protect my credit. And that's not true necessarily. You can get a free daily credit monitoring through a place called Credit Karma. Even better, you can
really
put, yeah.
You, wow.
Even better, you can put
who is
a,
that again, Mike?
It's Credit Karma. That's K-A-R-M-A. Credit Karma. And then it says here, you know, even better, you can put a security freeze with each credit bureau for at most a nominal fee to help prevent identity thieves from
a little bit of an inconvenience when you're trying to get a mortgage.
Yeah, you don't want to do that when you're trying to buy a house.
It adds tons of time, but it's worth it to keep yourself protected.
Anyways, good info.
That's great, Mike. Thank you so much. Back in March of 2008, when J.P. Morgan Chase acquired Bear Stearns for a fraction of what the company was worth, they had no idea what might be coming up in the future.
For those who've been demanding someone on Wall Street pay for the financial crisis, well, this may be the way that they get their pound of flesh, according to sources close to the case, because there could be more lawsuits where this one came from. It's the first product of a mortgage securities fraud working group, including federal prosecutors and state attorneys general, announced by President Obama in his State of the Union speech in January.
This new unit will hold accountable those who broke the law, speed assistance to homeowners, and help turn the page on an era of reckless that hurt so many Americans.
The story in this lawsuit is familiar by now. Bear Stearns allegedly became so obsessed with churning out mortgage-backed securities that it did almost no due diligence on the underlying mortgages while claiming to investors that it did. Then the housing bubble burst and you know the rest. Despite multiple investigations up and down Wall Street, prosecutors have had almost no luck making criminal charges stick. And the effort really lost steam in 2009 when two Bear Stearns fund fund managers, Ralph Chiaffi and Matthew Tenine, were acquitted on criminal charges. Since then, there's been little incentive for Wall Street execs to cooperate with prosecutors. So this is a new approach. According to a federal official familiar with the investigation, more than a dozen federal prosecutors and civil attorneys helped develop this case, which New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is bringing in civil court under the state's powerful Martin Act. And sources say that collaboration is potentially a model for future cases, though they won't say when those cases are coming or who they might be filed against. So will it work? Well, J.P. Morgan says it will fight the suit, which a spokesman says involves conduct at Bear Stearns long before it was acquired by J.P. Morgan over a weekend at the behest of the federal government. Nonetheless, the spokesman says J.P. Morgan is continuing to cooperate with the president's working group, which it appears may have some new power, and if this lawsuit works, some fuel.
So Bear Stearns was packaging mortgages and selling them to Wall Street to investors in the form of mortgage-backed securities. Now, the purpose of packaging mortgages was really to reduce the risk of individual mortgages. The idea was to have a high percentage of quality loans and a small percentage of the risky loans. Here's what happened. It was a high percentage of risky loans and a really small percentage of good performing loans. So mortgage-backed securities and bonds issued by investment companies, the investment companies create portfolios of mortgages by buying loans from mortgage lenders around the nation. Investors who buy bonds tied to the funds received bond interest payments that comprise of principal and interest payments received on underlying mortgages. This is the first action to come out of the working group created by President Obama, who are looking into the causes of the 2008 financial crash. So first one, it'll be interesting to see if it actually comes together. And all I have to say is, poor Chase.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they actually get somewhere with it, right?
Exactly. So one last thing I want to share during Money Chat before we get to our awesome guest that we have in studio here. Have you ever dreamed of having your mortgage disappear?
Yes.
Wouldn't it be nice? You want an early Christmas present?
Yeah, I do.
Bank of America is giving out early Christmas presents. They are forgiving second mortgages. Forgiving, meaning they're completely washing out second mortgages. They announced last Friday that they are in the process of mailing out roughly 150,000 letters to distressed homeowners offering to pay off their second mortgages. As part of the, which we've talked before, the National Foreclosure or the National Mortgage Settlement Act that came, that $25 billion act that came into play in March of this year, the bank started mailing the letters back in July and will continue to inform qualified homeowners throughout the year. Now, the program is what they call opt-out, meaning the borrower's second mortgage will be fully paid off unless the customer contacts the bank within 30 days to deny it. So get this, you actually have to request to have it denied, otherwise your second mortgage just disappears.
That just sounds too good to be true.
It's not too good to be true. It's happening. And what we're seeing in Washington State, out of that $25 billion settlement, $625 million was set aside just to benefit homeowners here in Washington State. Now, you need to be in distress, which means that you're delinquent either on your first mortgage or your second mortgage to initially qualify. You have to be underwater. So here's what Bank of America says. The logic is to ease the pain of struggling homeowners who are also dealing with issues on their first mortgage and help them create equity in their properties. Here's the real translation of that. They're not going to make their money on their second mortgage. They're right. Getting bad press out there. There's a $25 billion lawsuit that was specifically set up to help the banks make it easier for people to keep their homes. So now if the second disappears because they're not going to get paid on it anyway, there's a better chance the homeowner's going to actually keep the property if they're not underwater and if they eliminate the second mortgage. So it's kind of one of those things. It's the best of the best for both. The banks are benefiting and the consumer and the homeowner is going to benefit too. Now, the timing is perfect because, as we've talked before on the show, that the end of this year, the Mortgage Debt Relief Act possibly expires. So if this act expires, and that's why they're getting these out, and I can tell you, if I have examples of clients that have received a letter in the mail and have called me to ask if this is really true. And it is. We're going to see a lot more of this happening. Now, the timing through the end of the year is because if this does not get extended, the Mortgage Debt Relief Act doesn't get extended. If you had a $50,000 second mortgage and the bank decided to forgive it without this act, it's getting reported to the IRS, and it's still going to get reported to the IRS. You get a 1099, which means that now you have $50,000 income that you earned in a 25% tax bracket. That means you owe $12,500 to the IRS. So that's not a lot of fun. You have to kind of weigh out whether it's worth to get rid of $50,000 knowing that you're going to get this big tax bill. But with the Mortgage Debt Relief Act, not expiring until the end of the year, and possibly they're going to extend it because they feel that this is going to be devastating. That's a whole other topic which we've brought to studio before, but that's the strategy of getting this done through the end of the year. So it's real. It's not too good to be true. Here's the call to action. If you're a client with Bank of America, look for that letter. You can call to see if you qualify. It's not going to help by requesting it. You either qualify or you don't qualify. But here's the thing that you may be listening to right now. If you heard me mention, it's for people that are in distress. So what about all of you that are not delinquent on your mortgage payment? What about all of you that are not having challenges in making your payment? Why aren't you getting help? You actually can. You just need to have legal advice. Pick up the phone. Call our show. 1-888-776-1090. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090, or online at themoneyhour.com, and we will connect you with a law firm that can represent you into taking advantage of this $25 billion national mortgage settlement that's out there for you as well. We just talked about credit and how there's inaccuracies and violations in credit. Trust me. If your loan's with Bank of America, there are violations on the back end of your mortgage. So you can use that to have a possible reduction on your mortgage as well. So that was what I have for Money Chat today.
Good info, team.
Pretty cool stuff, huh?
And it would be interesting to see if the other banks jump on board.
Yeah, and they will, because there's five. The five major banks are part of that act. So that's a good point, Mike. I'm sure they absolutely will follow right behind. Coming up next on The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, we have Jim Einot, attorney at law, to discuss the importance of estate planning. If you have children, you will not want to miss out.
Baseball, the national pastime. It's basic, simple. In a time when, for a lot of Americans, many things are not. Your local Allstate agent can help make things a bit easier by saving you money on car insurance. Right off the bat, safe drivers can save up to 25%. Are you in good hands?
Get big league insurance for less. In Seattle, call Allstate agent Brett Stenmo first. Discount subject to terms and availability. Discount amount subject to change. Actual savings vary. Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois.
Do you want to prevent the state from taking your property if you pass away? Have you planned for your passing? It's time for you to get a will and estate planning documents. You can get a free half-hour consultation with attorney Jim Einot to discuss and review all of the necessary documents. He'll work with you to make sure your intent and estate planning needs are satisfied. Jim Einot has worked with hundreds of families and business owners to ensure an orderly transition of business and property after a person has passed.
This is Jim Einot, and I look forward to hearing from you and to provide a free half-hour consultation regarding your estate planning needs. My number is 425-827-6490. Please give me a call at 425-827-6490. I look forward to hearing from you.
This is The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on AM 1090. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance experts Dina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer here on AM 1090 every Saturday at 3 p.m. The purpose of our show is to help our listeners understand what's really going on in our local real estate market and financial arena. You can reach Tina and me at 1-888-776-1090 or contact us online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090 or online at themoneyhour.com. Right now, we're going to talk with Jim Einot, attorney at law. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, Jim has been practicing law for well over 30 years, has lived and worked around the East Side for 30 plus years. Jim, I know your practice covers a lot, but today we're only going to have time to talk about estate planning. But estate planning, real estate transactions, real estate litigation, you know, I've known you personally. I've worked with you for over, at least the last 12 years. So really appreciate you you being here today.
Oh, this is great, Mike. Glad to be here.
So, Jim, I think we should just start out about wills. I think we talk about procrastination and a lot of things in our life. And I think in your arena, more than any other one, there's procrastination. People just wait and they wait too long until they've died. And there's nothing you can go back and fix at that time. And I think the basic of just starting out with a will. Can you open us up with that?
I can. Actually, I've got a line that I deal with that, Tina, is I say estate planning by vacation. So every time somebody wants to go to Hawaii, they think they better get a will. And so they say, I want a will by Tuesday because I'm flying out on Wednesday morning.
Oh.
And so I call it estate planning by vacation.
Well, at least it's something to get them to take that step, right?
Some sort of motivation.
When they get over the water, they feel like they need a will. So it is interesting. The other thing is there is a prejudice, if you will, or bias about people thinking if they get a will, they're going to have bad health or something's going to happen to them.
Uh-huh.
The opposite's true. We want to plan for it. We want to be ready. And with the uncertainty of the other documents that are needed in addition to a will, it's really important for people to have it, to be ready and be prepared, not only for themselves, but how others can take care of them, as well as for their children and everybody else to handle as they go through life's eventual runs, one way or the other.
It almost seems somewhat selfish for somebody to not have a will if you have a spouse or if you have kids or you have family.
Because, that's a good point, Mike.
You know,
it's not only selfish, it certainly disorganizes everything that you've planned. So it's a lot harder to transfer assets. It's especially a lot harder to transfer real estate. And if somebody has particular assets to give to one of their children, they lose the ability to control and to designate that if they don't have a will. So having a will really accomplishes what you've spent your life doing and what your intent has been. So it's a mystery to me why that doesn't happen and why people aren't anxious to do more of that.
So you just said lose control. Who wants to lose control? Who wants to have the state and the courts come in and make a decision for them?
And nobody does, but I think what you hit right off the bat, Tina, was that people procrastinate. And it's something that they will get to, or they feel that they'll get to.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic documents that I recommend people to have as a minimum is a will, and that's obviously in case somebody passes away. I also recommend that people do a living will, and a living will in Washington, we call a directive to physicians, and that's if somebody was on a life support system so that the family knows that the person's intent is the pull of services and the plug, if you will, of life support. So when they're in a persistent vegetative state, that the family knows what the intent is. More importantly, I think, is the durable power of attorney for healthcare decisions. And I see this a lot for Alzheimer's patients. They can't handle bank accounts. They can't handle their statements. Somebody needs to be able to step up. And by having a simple, durable power of attorney, they have their son, daughter, whoever they may choose as a financial advisor to handle those things. And it saves the family a tremendous amount of agony. It saves them a lot of money in terms of getting a guardian appointed, a guardian ad litem to evaluate the need for that. So it's a very simple document, but has very important consequences to somebody.
So, Jim, I don't want to make sure I'm not getting confused here, but isn't there also, is it part of the will that protects, because I don't think anybody thinks about this, if you're listening and you have a teenager, why would you need to get something set up for a teenager?
And that's really important. For instance, with my children, and this will probably be the first time they hear about it, I've set up a trust if something happened to Carolyn and myself, so that the assets would be held until age 25. They'd get half at 25 and half at 30. And the intent there was to have somebody like a trustee control the money so that they would go to school, they would have somebody to pay for their expenses, and they couldn't have immediate access to it. So I was able to get what I thought was important to control that. Then, of course, if they get some money at 25 and they don't handle it right, they get another chance at age 30. So that was the intent, was to give them a second chance for handling money. What I have seen over the years is that getting a lot of money, we work and strive to accumulate money. But overall, if a young person gets it and is sort of given it, I see it as a tremendous disincentive. And the person that they want to become and the parents want them to become, it's hard to keep that incentive to work hard, be diligent when you have a lot of money sitting in the account.
Sure, absolutely.
And if you don't set up a trust for that child, they get it at age 18. I'm sure you were very responsible at age 18,
of
Tina.
Course.
But
I was.
I know Mike was.
Absolutely.
Not.
I only used you, Tina, specifically. So
Jim knows me too well.
So it gives a good pattern and control of the money. So that's really a logical, practical thing that everybody wants to do. And it's real important to do that.
You know, and if you think about it, today it's so common to have families that are commingled, right? So you're talking about stepdaughter, stepkids, or stepbrother, stepsisters, and what a nightmare that must be if one of the parents passes, because you just, those are things that you just didn't really think about much, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago. But
that's a great point, Mike. And what I usually tell people is that if there are three or more siblings, we have two or more problems. And it's important for the estate planner to think at least two or three levels deep. And so we plan on contingencies. And so we say, what if this happens? And everybody has the first level pretty well thought out. If he dies, she gets it. If she dies, he gets it. But what if your kids predecease you? Does it go past to their children? What if, like Mike suggested, there's stepchildren involved? Who gets what? And that planning and intent is really important. And we spend a great deal of time with the clients to accomplish that. And we can reach those goals if you have a written document.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, I heard a story that was really sad to listen to about a mother that had her child in college, and something devastating happened to the child and their health while they were in college, and the mother was not allowed to go in there and make decisions. Can you talk about that, and how would you protect from that happening? Because I would imagine the worst thing is to obviously have something devastating happen to your child. They're not passed away, but they're incapacitated, and you don't have any control into making decisions, especially what's going on with at the college.
And we're seeing a lot of that thing with the older population, Tina, but it does happen to the younger ones as well. And we obviously can't predict that. But what we do is a durable power of attorney for financial and healthcare matters.
Okay.
And so the durable means that it's not a present intent. It only applies if somebody is incapacitated. So the document is prepared with the idea or expectation that it's only to be used if somebody can't make decisions for themselves. And so you immediately have a power of attorney appointed if they're incapacitated. And I do it for financial matters, like I've suggested. I get a lot of Alzheimer's patients where the family has to use it. I also do it for healthcare power of attorney, because if there's an auto accident and somebody can't consent to surgery, I now have a power of attorney that can immediately step in and make all of the immediate critical decisions right off the bat. So those two documents are part of my basic estate plan package, and I think everybody should have them. They're simple documents. If you don't have it, it really becomes complicated, and you have to go to court, and it becomes expensive as well.
When you hear the word trustee, I think a lot of people often think of that this is like some official person, and a trustee can simply just be a family friend, right?
Yeah.
So when you talk about a trustee or a guardian, a personal representative, it's all kind of the same thing, right?
It does, but they have different duties. So I typically recommend that we have multiple people serving in different capacities. In particular, a trustee typically handles the money. So that may be the money of the child until the child reaches the age that the person wants to give that child the money. It can be any age. It's discretionary. So the trustee typically handles the money. I like to have a different person be guardian of the minor children, because then I have a little bit of a check and balance. Is the guardian getting the money that the guardian's supposed to get to care for the kids at home or to pay for food and the household expenses? And if not, you've got somebody to check on that right away. Why not? Where's the money going? Why isn't it being paid properly? And the creditors aren't getting paid. So they can be the same person, but I found that some people have caring skills and some people have financial skills, and rarely do you see the combination of the two. Another thing that I do there is that I tell the parents to write a letter to the trustee and write a letter to the guardian, and give your intent of how you want your child raised. So the guardian, if it's a religious preference, if it's a financial preference or an education preference, spell that out for the guardian so they'll know what your intent is. And it's not legally binding, but morally I've seen the guardians really do their best to follow it, even if their philosophy is different. And they say, look, it's my sister or brother's kid, I'm going to follow their intent, and they've spelled it out. And I do the same thing with financial matters. Hey, trustee, we want these kids to be happy. We want them to have enough money to feel comfortable going to college, and we don't want them to work, or we want them to work. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you might pay for books and tuition, but not for living expenses. And so you can control that. And that's the ability and the beauty of having a document created for especially the way you want it.
There are so many life events that you can prepare for right now. And if you wait, it might be too late. If you're listening today and you don't have an estate planning representative, you need to pick up the phone, give our show a call, 1-888-776-1090. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090. Or you can reach us online at themoneyhour.com. We'll connect you directly with Jim. You can also go to Jim's site, jamesrinot.com. That's jamesrinot.com. Jim, let's get back to a will. Can you record or file that?
You can. So King County now, or the counties, will allow the will to be filed. You can file it like a regular court document. So they have a will repository for that. I don't usually encourage or recommend that, because we can change wills anytime that we want. The language that the attorneys use, it's a precatory document, which means it's wishful.
That's a big word.
And it's intent. It's what your intent is, but it can change any time. So when you have the old movies where somebody says, I'm going to disinherit you today, they actually can disinherit you today.
Got it.
And so it's wishful. It changes regularly. I found that most people, after 5 to 7 years, they don't have the same friends. They don't have the same neighbors. So guardians can change. Family members obviously don't, but family members move, so they're no longer in the same area or location, and you have some other issues to deal with. Mm-hmm. So it is a document that is capable and oftentimes changed.
Kind of like a mortgage, Mike. I mean, people want to get a mortgage review once a year. Mm-hmm. You want to have your estate planning documents reviewed at least once a year, right?
Sure. That'd be a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea.
Things change.
Yeah.
And you must see this too, is the question be, if you're a domestic partner, you know, do you need a will? You know, because so many people nowadays as well, they may have been previously married, but are, you know, currently living with somebody. Maybe they decide that, you know, they've been down that road. They don't necessarily want to marry again, but they've been living with the person for 5, 7, 10, 12 years. How important is it for that person to have a will?
It's very important. Our Domestic Partnership Act has clarified that role as far as inheritance, and that they can inherit from each other without a problem. They've passed community property laws for registered domestic partnership. So that has helped that area of the law. Obviously, we have a referendum in November that will make additional issues if it passes. So it's easier for them to get the assistance at the medical facilities and that type of thing. But having a durable power of attorney for that is a very simple document that that also ensures it in writing. And the hospitals don't reject or deny that. And so you force their hand a lot more if you've done it properly and prepared and have a document. They can still access the care and support for people, but it's a lot easier when you have a written document for it. And I found the hospitals always honor it.
And Liz, Mike's not asking about himself about not getting married again. Just saying.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Tina. Thank you for clarifying that.
I had to clarify that.
But that brings up another issue, and this one is a fairly common one that I see, is that on life insurance, IRAs, pension plans, stock plans, bank accounts, we typically designate a beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if those beneficiaries change and you no longer want that person to get that account or that money or that asset, mm-hmm. you have to change the beneficiary.
Absolutely.
And so even if you have a will that says it goes to somebody else, if the beneficiary is designated, that's what the company will honor.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, in life insurance, if the beneficiary is designated as person B, but your will says you want A to get it, B will get it unless mm-hmm. you change the beneficiary on a designated account. We call those non-probate assets because they don't follow according to the will. They follow for a contract that you make with that company. Bank accounts, 401ks, stockbrokers, life insurance, those are all the real critical issues that I see there. And you do need to change it, and you do need to pay attention.
Well, that's
to
important,
it.
And I bet you go through a checklist of, you know, because a lot of that stuff is just plain stuff people wouldn't think to even, they wouldn't even remember that they've, you know, they have these accounts and they need to go back and change that. So
it is true, Mike, because most of the time they just think that the will controls and they don't understand non-probate assets, or the banks sort of lull people into saying, this is, just put it as a joint account.
Yep.
And I've had many cases where the mother, because the daughter, they have a close mother-daughter relationship, and the rest of the siblings are essentially disinherited mm-hmm. because they'll put all the money into one account to make it easy.
Sure.
And then they'll put the daughter on as a joint tenant with the right of survivorship. That daughter legally has the entire account, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that the will was supposed to be shared amongst five people. And so most of the time they've come morally and they've said, okay, I know mom didn't intend that.
Sure.
But it causes a lot of concern to a lot of different people in those situations.
So Jim, for our listeners today that are listening to the show right now, in wrap up, what would be the best advice that you would give somebody listening?
I think is to see somebody, get the documents prepared, to do a will, a living will, a durable power of attorney for financial and health care. It's important to get those done. It's important for everybody in your family and your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a very expensive process. You can also avoid or certainly minimize taxes if you have an estate over $5 million, $2 million in the state of mm-hmm. Washington. And since they value that on the gross value of the state, it's critical that everybody gets the document done correctly.
Got it.
And to get it done.
It makes total sense. And those triggers and life changes, addition to your family, value in your real estate, your health, any other elder law changes is the time that you really need to pick up the phone and give you a call.
And I would just say in closing too, I would imagine you would agree that you should probably get, maybe talk to a couple of different attorneys or kind of get an idea of what they charge or what they do. Because I would imagine that the price range for what an attorney can charge for this can range quite a bit depending upon the attorney and what they're offering and that kind of stuff. So it's good to ask around.
But on that note, Mike, that's a good point. Using these online, I mean, there are so many people that go online to get these documents. You can't go online and prepare your own documents. You need to talk to a professional that understands. I mean, am I correct, Jim?
I think you are, Tina. It's really important to customize them.
You get what you pay for, right?
Well, I think so. And not only that, but the times where people have said, look, prepare them, and I'll sign them and send you copies back. They're, more often than not, there's something wrong with them. And they didn't validly sign them or execute them in a way that makes them valid.
Sure.
And so there's just too many ways to make too many mistakes.
Do you have a consultation appointment first just to kind of meet them and talk to them and kind of get an idea of what it is they're looking for and then kind of base it off of that?
I am, Mike. As part of this show, I'm offering a free half-hour consultation just to discuss their wills and their plans,
Jim.
As part
Thank
of
you.
That.
Okay.
So,
and that's a huge offer. And again, it's just for listening to our show right here on AM 1090, The Money Hour. Give Jim a call. He's doing a free consultation just for you, our listeners. Call the show, 1-888-776-1090. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090. And we will directly connect you with Jim for your free 30-minute consultation. Jim, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
That was awesome. Thank you.
Both.
Coming up next in The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, you will not want to miss out. We have in studio Inger Lawrence with Windermere Real Estate. If you're thinking of selling your home, stay tuned. If you're thinking of buying a home, you won't want to miss the segment either. Coming up next.
Are you thinking of selling your home and haven't gone through the process in years? The internet has completely changed how buyers approach their purchase. Most buyers won't come to your home unless they first see something they like online. To get buyers in the door and writing an offer, contact Inger Lawrence with Windermere Greenwood. Inger has the construction and design background to help you optimize your opportunity to get top dollar in the shortest amount of time.
This is Inger Lawrence. Let's work together for a great outcome. Contact me at either 206-321-1626 or inger@windermere.com. Again, that is 206-321-1626. Or inger@windermere.com.
Now back to the Money Hour on AM 1090 with your host Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer here on AM 1090 every Saturday at 3 p.m. sharp. The purpose of our show is to help our listeners understand what's really going on in our local real estate market and financial arena. You can reach Tina and me at 1-888-776-1090 or contact us online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090 or online at themoneyhour.com. Tina?
Maximize your sale through preparation. Is that what we're going to talk about?
That's right.
Awesome.
So we've got Inger Lawrence with Windermere Real Estate with us. And, you know, it's interesting. I've met a lot of real estate agents over the past 15 years, but it's always interesting to hear like what their other backgrounds were before getting into real estate or along with real estate. And Inger has been in real estate since 1996. She focuses primarily on in-city single-family residences and multi-family properties. But here's what's interesting. Inger, you have a background in construction and as well as in design. And we're just really excited to hear how that background plays out with you and your clients.
Actually, it's kind of an interesting combination. The construction really helps me a lot in actually for both sellers and buyers, because from a seller's perspective, they're always looking at, you know, what can we do to kind of maximize our dollar from our house? And there's a lot of easy things you can do from kind of a construction basis that can, you know, maximize your dollars, kind of eliminate the red flags for buyers. And then from a buyer's perspective, I can always walk in and say, hey, you know, if you take off the wallpaper here and paint, or if you mm-hmm. just tear up the carpets, you've got wood floors, just some really simple things that are a lot of times low cost, even as far as, you know, maybe a kitchen that's dated. And like Mike just pointed out, I do a lot of in-city homes. So with in-city homes, you're not dealing quite often with brand new construction. You're dealing with older homes that have been updated a variety of times over the years. So sometimes you can take an 80s cabinet and just paint it, put some new pulls on it, and call it a day. So from a seller's perspective, it's a really low-cost way of kind of updating the look.
And I think more than ever in this environment that we're in, there is multiple offers on any house that's listed at any competitive price. There's just not enough homes out there for all of the people that want and see the benefit of homeownership right now. And so even more than before, not to say that it's not always important, because preparing your home is always going to bring you a higher net proceed. But in this environment, it's whether or not your home's going to actually be talked about to where it's going to bring in those buyers. So what does preparation of your home really encompass?
Well, Well, it basically encompasses everything that you do prior to listing your home for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of neurotic about it. In fact, I drive my husband crazy sometimes.
Which we have in studio. Byron, yes, thanks, for, Byron here. Thanks for being here, Byron. Okay, he doesn't have a mic, but he's here.
Yeah, well, I can drive him crazy because I am very, very meticulous about making sure that I look at every single aspect of your home inside and out, so that I can kind of foresee what are objections to buyers. And we definitely want to eliminate those as much as possible. So whatever you do in advance of listing your home is going to benefit you. Because, you know, buyers in this market, because it is so strong right now and there's multiple offers, they're going to see it the minute it comes online and they're going to want to come see it right away.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really have that luxury of, oh, well, we should have done this, we should have done that, and 2 weeks later, think about it. You need to do it up front before you list.
If I'm thinking about selling my home, what exactly would my first step be?
Absolutely. First step is get some input. We live in our homes. We just aren't as objective about the condition and what's going on with it. We don't see it the way that fresh eyes would see it. So definitely you want to get some input.
And you'd mentioned you got to do it up front. And again, I want to stress on that for somebody that's listening. It's so important to hear what Inger just said. You need to do it up front because you can't backtrack and do it later, because once your home has been listed on the market for what's considered a long time right now, a couple weeks, a home in a good market area.
Definitely.
You know, so
a
if it's if you've gotten there to where your home has reached over what our local market average would be of the home being there, it's too late to go back because people already are looking at your home as old inventory, and there's got to be something wrong with the home if it hasn't sold by now. And then we all know, being in the industry, you got to pull it off the market and wait, get it back on. And so how much money have you lost during that time? I just think it's so important in the preparation of your home to make sure that you're not only getting top dollar, but you're actually able to sell the home and not have to remove it from the market. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
So who should I go to first? Inger, I know the answer, but I want you to tell the listeners. Who do you go to first to get the input that you need for preparation on your home?
Well, it kind of depends on what your game plan is. If you're planning on using the services of a realtor, definitely call them first. Call them before you do anything. Quite often what I find is that when I come to a home, the homeowner is so excited to explain to me everything that they've done to prepare their home for sale. Well, some things are good and maybe some things are a little bit too personal to them. What mm-hmm. you really want to do is you want to gear your home towards the buyer. Who is that buyer that's going to walk into your home? You want to make sure that the colors that you choose for paint and, you know, all of the upgrades, if you do any, are going to appeal to your buyer and not to your personal style. And that's sometimes the downside to not getting other people involved up front, is that you don't really target your buyer. You just kind of, you know, pick what you like. And sometimes that isn't necessarily what they want.
I can't imagine the hilarious stories you must have over all the years of working with sellers as they, and trying to delicately advise them on why their current fashion
that's a good
thing. Yeah. Well, may not be the best thing.
And I really have to kind of tone it down because I am a very direct person. So definitely, I mean, you want to be honest with people because it's to their benefit to know what needs to be done. But at the same time, you have to be sensitive to their feelings for sure, because people are very emotionally invested in their homes quite often.
I guess you could call that advice without insult.
Yes.
Yeah. Right? Well, and Mike, exactly. I mean, for you, do you want to hire a realtor that's not direct with you and is not telling you the truth, telling you what you want to hear? Or do you want to have somebody that says, hey, look, this is the reality. This is what you got to do to make your home sell.
Absolutely. I'd want the truth, but sometimes the truth hurts a little.
Yeah. Well, and I think the one thing that I ran across that is the most delicate is when there's pets involved, because pets are like family members. And quite often you really do have to address concerns with either pet odors or too much pet paraphernalia around the home.
I'm not going to be offended as long as you don't tell me I have to get rid of my pet, then it's all good.
Yeah, I've got two dogs and two cats.
Like, yeah, I only had to do that once, but yeah. He was perfectly fine
now
with
my
it.
Husband, it's okay, not the dog.
Yeah. So is there any harm in figuring all this out on your own? And I know that's a loaded question. I mean, I know the answer to that as well, but what would you speak to that? Somebody's just going to try to, I can just figure this out all by myself.
Sometimes people can do it. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, there's people out there definitely that have a wonderful sense of style and they know exactly what to do. They know exactly who they're they're marketing their home towards and whatnot. So that's fine. But my attitude is always, why not just get some extra input? You know, more heads are better than one. And so, especially if you're going to hire a realtor, they're used to working with buyers every single day. They mm-hmm. know what they're looking for and what they're not. So maybe there's something that you overlooked or you could change that's just minor. It's all about just perfecting the product, because that's basically what it is. If you're planning on selling your home yourself, which is fine, get some family members, friends, whatever, just make sure they have a really great sense of style.
Right.
So, Inger, you get together with your clients. Let's say one of our listeners gave you a call and wanted to talk to you about putting their home on the market, and you go through that list of all of those items, because there's probably a lot of things that could be improved. How do you kind of break that down to get it to where it might be doable and efficient cost-wise?
Well, I mean, that always is a big concern. And the one thing that you have to talk to people about, or, you know, they need to address is what is in their budget? What makes sense to do and what doesn't make sense to do? And I always look at it from a perspective of, what are you going to get back for what you're putting into it? If you're putting in $2,000 and it's a return of $5,000 for you, it's a no-brainer. If you're going to completely remodel your kitchen and you're in a neighborhood that maybe doesn't support that remodel, then maybe just paint out the cabinets instead. So, you know, you really have to look at what makes sense for the individual home, for the neighborhood, for the price point that the home is at, and then just go from there. Definitely, if nothing else, make a list, and anything that you can do that's free or relatively free, do it. You know, that would be cleaning off your counters, mowing your lawn, freshening up the paint on your front door, all of those types of things.
What's the next step for the person to do? So you kind of discussed all of that. You have an idea on what their budget is, what can be done. Where do you go from there?
Well, definitely, once you've evaluated what you're going to do, then I would definitely start packing. You know, I always stress that to my clients, because it's one thing that you're going to have to do anyway. If you're moving, you're going to be out of there. You're going to pack your things. When you do it up front, you have the luxury of time in most situations, unless, you know, you have a job transfer and you have to be out within 30 days. But most people have 2 to 3 months or whatever before they're going to list their home for sale. So I just tell them, you know, start packing. Pack up anything that you're not going to use for the next few months. Give away anything that you're not going to take with you. Give it away, sell it, whatever, so it's out of your home. And then anything like knickknacks, or if you have an excessive amount of personal things, just pack them up and either put them in the garage, put them in the basement in a corner, or in a storage room or something like that. What it does is it makes your home bigger, more spacious, and it also eliminates people coming in and getting distracted by all your personal things, and really giving them the opportunity to focus on the home.
So I know showing a home vacant with no furniture at all is not usually the best, but it's probably better than if what most of the furniture they have is just not going to work from a design standpoint. Do you sometimes look at staging? Do you hire stagers? I mean, I guess this goes back to the budget.
Correct.
But if it's a choice of leaving the furniture in there, which may not be the best from a fashion standpoint, or having the home, you know, completely empty, what do you advise?
Well, it kind of depends on the situation. If you're living in the home, it really is not feasible for you to get rid of all your furniture and sleep on a mattress on the floor. So that really isn't an option. And what I find with most people is they do have some furniture that you can use. So definitely go through room by room, figure out, okay, what can I use? What works in this room? Keep that. And then the things that are maybe tattered, worn out, just really out of style, you know, like a big oversized easy chair is probably something you might want to store in the garage while you're selling your home. But I rarely find a home that I can't use some of their furniture. So an option would be to keep what works, get rid of what doesn't work, and go from there. If it's vacant, definitely some staging helps, because everything is done online now, and a vacant home does not shoot well and show well online. It's just big empty rooms, and it's just not very appealing.
So if you just tuned in listening to the Money Hour on AM 1090, we have in studio today Inger Lawrence with Windermere Real Estate, and we're talking with her about maximizing your sale through preparation. So we've talked about the first step is preparation, deciding what you need to do your home, what's going to be most efficient and most cost effective for you, especially in this economic environment. Next is to really get your things packed up. organize, get them cleared out of the home, and staging. Where do you go from there, Inger?
Well, where you go from there is get it done. You know, just
get her done.
Get it done. Well, you know, it just boils down to that. You know, just start working off of your list. Get the things accomplished that you can do. If you need to hire a tradesperson to do some of the things, it kind of depends on your skill set, too. You know, I know people that can do tiling and can do painting and can do, you know, some minimal carpentry work. So if you have that skill set, do it, because you definitely aren't paying for the labor. But if you have to hire tradespeople, have them get in and get the work done, and you're ready to go.
So we haven't talked much about the outside of the property. What advice would you give there?
Well, definitely the outside is important. I mean, I literally have had people in the car, and you pull up to a home, and if it is not appealing from the outside, sometimes they're just not excited about the home from the get-go. I mean, you really have to not drag them in the house, but you have to really coax them into the home. So you definitely want to, and this is the one thing I see all the time, is front porch, front door, paint it. I don't know how many times I go to grab a rail on the way into a home and the paint is peeling off the rail. It is so easy to fix. Definitely it leaves a first impression. So just freshen it up. Put some flower pots on the front. Make sure your lawn is mowed. Pull weeds, that's free. Trim the hedges. Just do some things to just freshen up the outside, so when people drive by or pull up to see your home, that they have a good feeling from the start.
So if you're listening today, the main purpose of our show, I mean, we're here to talk about money, everything that affects your money, but also we're here to connect you with the best of the best in our local market. We have Inger here in studio today. She is one of the best in the real estate arena. Give the show a call, 1-888-776-1090, or go online to themoneyhour.com. We will connect you with either one of our guests in studio here. Jim, thank you so much for coming in. Inger, thank you. What an awesome topic to bring up, especially for all those sellers out there in the market right now.
Thanks, guys.
And next week in studio, we have back Janice Hammond, owner of Sunrise Financial Services. And Janice is part of our wealth management team here for the Money Hour. What we're going to talk about is the top worries that people are nearing retirement. And even better than that, we're going to give you the solutions for it. So you won't want to miss next week with Janice. Mike, who else do we have in studio?
Next week, Tina, we have Chris Dossett with Sotheby's Real Estate. And she actually is going to talk pretty much the whole segment about staging. She actually owns a staging business. She has a warehouse full of furniture, and she's going to talk about all the different things that go into that as an agent, and what kind of staging stuff she can provide for her clientele. Very, very high-end clientele.
Exciting show.
This is Mike Mercer signing off for the Mortgage Diva, Tina Mitchell.
And this is Tina Mitchell signing off for the Mortgage Master, Mike Mercer. Enjoy your weekend, everyone. Thank you again for being here this Saturday. Don't miss next Saturday. We'll see you right here, AM 1090 at 3 p.m. Have a great weekend.
Hey, guys, have a great week.